That hymn is especially appropriate, I think, for our speaker this morning, Cynthia Reyes, who wrote a wonderful memoir of her life in Jamaica and her immigration to Canada called A Good Home, and it is about her spiritual journey. It's received accolades from a wide variety of sources, and it tells the story of her life and relationships in dwellings as varied as a small pink farmhouse in Jamaica, a mountainside log cabin in Vancouver, and a Victorian farmhouse near Toronto. A Good Home is also about dislocation and relocation, faith and doubt, and the support of loved ones, including her church community at St. Thomas Church, Brooklyn, in this diocese. And I first got to know Cynthia when she started coming with the women's group from St. Thomas on retreats at the convent. And it's been a great pleasure to get to know her. She is a former journalist and executive producer with the CBC. More than 100 episodes of her programs have appeared on network TV. She's the winner of national and international awards and acclaim for her trailblazing work as a leader in the television industry, including Children's Broadcast Institute Award and the Crystal Award for Outstanding Achievement in Film and Television. She's published nonfiction stories in Arabella magazine, one of the fastest growing magazines in the United States and Canada, focusing on architecture and the arts, as well as in the Globe and Mail and the Huffington Post and Toronto Life. Very varied publications. So I want to introduce Cynthia to you now, and I know you'll enjoy and appreciate and profit from the message she has for us this morning. Cynthia.
Thank you, Connie, for that kind introduction. And thanks to Reverend Brian Ransom and all of you from Lansing United and St. George's Anglican for the invitation to be with you here today at St. George's in your beautiful sanctuary, in your beautiful new building. Now, I know something about the change and upheaval and sacrifice it takes to renovate, which I know is happening at Lansing, or build a new church, because that's exactly what happened recently at St. Thomas Church in Brooklyn, where I served as warden, and my husband, Hamlin, served as co-chair of the Capitol Committee that raised the funds to build our new space. For our family, church in Brooklyn is home, and even though we've moved away from Brooklyn, we still go back and attend church there on Sunday mornings, except, of course, today. So you know it's going to happen. The church police is going to be calling our home. Do you have the church police at your churches? Very soon to make sure that we're okay. And I'm very thankful for the church police, I tell you. The first thing I'm... Cameron, could you pass the book for me? Because I forgot that. The first thing I'm going to do is to read a short excerpt from my book, A Good Home. And I'm going to set the context for you before I do that. It's only a few years after our family started attending church at St. Thomas in Brooklyn. We'd moved to the village a few years earlier and started going to church there. And the priest, Father David, comes to our house one Sunday afternoon after church and says, would you become our warden? And I laughed. And then, after some discussion, I very foolishly said yes. And if you've been a warden yourself or know anybody who's been a warden, you know it's hard work. And so when I say I foolishly said yes, you'll understand what I mean. I didn't know what I was in for. Before I knew it, the old rectory that our parish used to own but had sold 50 years before was up for sale. And the village of Brooklyn had been in the last 10 years or so been growing rapidly, and the church was bursting at the seams. So we needed to buy back that land in order to expand. Luckily for us, the person that owned the old rectory and the land was Gloria. In her 80s, she was our envelope secretary, and she had agreed to give us right of first refusal, Is that how it works? Yeah. First refusal on buying the place. So she contacts us, and somehow or the other, I become the leader in the decision as to whether or not we will be able to afford to buy back the land in order to expand our old church to accommodate the growing population of Brooklyn. Not what I'd signed up for, okay? I signed up to pay the bills, get the building repaired when it needed to, get the snow cleared. I did not sign up for this, but there you had it. My mother always said, God never gives you more than you can handle, and I was about to find out. So I'm going to read from page 189 of my book. Overnight, can you hear me okay? Okay. Overnight, the lovely dream of buying back the rectory had turned into the awful reality of having the opportunity but no money to meet it. Worse, we knew that the church had no choice but to expand in the future if it was to provide a spiritual home for the many newcomers arriving in our village. To expand the church, we needed to own the land surrounding the old rectory right next door. Another Christmas, our busiest season, was approaching fast. It was clearly the wrong time to ask the parish to take on a huge debt of hundreds of thousands of dollars, especially in a church with financial anxiety in its DNA. We were on the verge of losing the old rectory, which one parishioner wrote would be a body blow to the whole parish. I appealed to the highest power I personally knew, my mother, once a church leader herself. Her wisdom, her faith in God, and her respect for the rightness of certain things were unassailable. Go talk to the people in your early morning congregation, my mother advised by telephone from Jamaica. You know them. They know you. They won't let the three of you shoulder this burden alone. And the three of us were the two wardens and Father David, our priest. The problem was, I didn't really know these folks. Coffee and a few laughs in the church kitchen after the service were one thing, but knowing them well enough to ask for big money, that was something else altogether. And those who claimed to know the 830 folks well insisted that they would be the last people at St. Thomas Anglican to support taking on a giant debt to buy the old rectory. Mark my words, a longtime 1030 member told me in the tone of one who knows. Those 830 folks won't go for it. They're extremely conservative. I'm sure you don't have these divisions in your churches, right? I'm sure. Now, faith, a biblical writer had explained, is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Mine was a small hope. My faith in these people was thin, shaky, and full of doubt. But Mother knows best, so I visited the 830 members who lived in the old village. I went from house to house, feeling tentative, uncertain, even fearful. When the first door opened, I was still rehearsing my speech. Their reactions astounded me, and I'm just getting shivers as I say this. One woman pledged $1,000 immediately. Her next words were stunning. I live on a pension, she said, but my house is free and clear. Please use it as collateral on a mortgage or however it can be used. I mean it. Another woman and her husband listened attentively as I sat in the living room of their old clapboard house and earnestly described the challenge. When I finished, they calmly committed to $1,000, promising more when they could afford it. Even more remarkable, the woman fiercely urged us to have faith in the parish. The moment you've told people how much you need, they will open their wallets, she said. She was right. The money started coming in, slowly at first. Then, as we persuaded the larger congregation to join us, faster and faster. Contributions ranged from a few dollars to several thousand. A young child gave a dollar, all the money he had in his piggy bank. We were all deeply moved by the sacrifices that people were willing to make to help their church. 2 weeks before Christmas, we had nearly 40% of the purchase price. Three parish families agreed to take out mortgages on the property, and the diocese provided a guarantee to the lenders. to our great joy, our offer to buy back the old rectory was accepted. Finally, the old rectory was coming home, bringing with it an unspoken promise. More newcomers would find hospitality at St. Thomas, a place where their spirit could feel at home. I stood with my mother, my husband, my daughters, and fellow parishioners that Christmas in St. Thomas Anglican, and my heart soared with happiness and gratitude. The whole church seemed to hum with new hope, faith, and hospitality for old-timers and strangers and any angels who might drop in unannounced. And this is from a chapter called Entertaining Angels, which I think you're all familiar with that expression in Hebrews. So that is that was my big involvement as a warden at St. Thomas. Now, allegedly there was a sign at Winchester Cathedral in England that said, "You are entering a conversation that began long before you were born and will continue long after you are dead." Have you ever heard it? No. I phoned Winchester Cathedral a few years ago and I said, "Do you still have that sign?" And they said, "What sign?" And so I told them. And they were all so young there, and even the priests were fairly new, that nobody remembered that sign. But this sign apparently was there about 20 years ago. So clearly that part of the conversation did not continue after those people left. But it's a great quote, and I think it speaks not only to our experiences in our church communities and our experiences with our own faith, but also the experience of the Black community in this country. And I'm going to repeat that quote. "You're entering a conversation that began long after you were born and will continue long after you are dead." In other words, that journey is a long one, and it doesn't start and end with us. We benefit from the struggles and sacrifices and faith of those who've gone before. And we do our part to make life better for future generations. That's the way for church parishes like mine and yours, and it's the way for Canada's Black community. We would not be here were it not for all the hard work that's gone before. Now, when we think of Black history, we often think of American Black history, and for decades, I would sometimes get frustrated. I'd say, "Oh, enough already." You know, there's Black history in this country as well. We also, however, more recently have gotten into thinking about people like Oscar Peterson and Lincoln Alexander and, you know, Carrie Best from Nova Scotia and so on and so forth. I wouldn't be here in Canada today if it were not for the sacrifices of all of those people, but also a group of community stalwarts who in the 1950s fought to change Canada's racist immigration laws. And my talk today is primarily about the Caribbean presence in Canada's Black history. Prime among this group who fought to change the laws were three men who were all born in the Caribbean: Donald Moore from Barbados, Harry Geary from Jamaica, and Bromley Armstrong, also from Jamaica. The story of how they took the train to Ottawa to petition the government to change the immigration laws are legendary today. Back then, Canada had a severe shortage of nurses, and Caribbean nurses were known for their excellent training. So the government let them in first, and domestic workers also followed. Over the years, teachers, accountants, doctors, and many others followed. In the mid-70s, I got my chance. My aunt and uncle in Kitchener-Waterloo sponsored me to come to Canada. They were doing well. She actually was a nurse, but together they owned an apartment building. They were paying a lot of taxes. They had no children of their own, and they wanted to benefit somebody from their family. So they brought me up from Jamaica. And I did what many immigrants did back then and still do today. I worked full-time, and I went to school full-time. And today people ask me, "How do you do that?" And I said, "Well, don't all immigrants do that?" I really thought that's what all immigrants did. I studied journalism at Ryerson in Toronto and worked at Bell Canada as a telephone operator. I was their multilingual operator because I spoke a number of languages. Then, just before I graduated, the CBC came to Ryerson and chose me for their very prestigious reporter trainee program. And that's how I ended up living in the log cabin on the mountainside in Vancouver. I had a wonderful career at the CBC, moving from one great job to another. And there's a point to this, so don't think I'm boasting, because I'm going to make a point at the end of it. In every role, I was the first Black, the first woman, or the youngest ever person to occupy that role. I became an executive producer, then head of journalism training and development for the CBC. In that role, I was responsible for improving programs and the skills of journalists right across the country, right across the CBC. I helped the South African Broadcasting Corporation to make the change from an instrument of apartheid. The SABC was actually the voice of the apartheid government. And my job was to lead a team of people from Canada, and there's another team from England and one, I think, from Australia, helping them to figure out how to become an independent broadcaster because apartheid was now ended. I was also Secretary General for the International Public Television Board called INPUT, and based in Canada and Italy and working throughout the world helping to improve public television. In the 1990s, I became the first Black person and one of the youngest ever to win the CBC President's Award and the TV Industries Broadcaster of the Future Award. In other words, I was a Canadian success story and one of the Black community's success stories. The sacrifices that had been made to bring me here had paid off for me. In my voluntary work, I also became head of the Black Business and Professional Association and led the nomination of the men who took the train to Canada, to Ottawa, Donald Moore and Harry Gary, for the Order of Canada. They were elderly then, while Bromley was still fairly young, so my priority was to get those two nominated for the Order of Canada. So, for me, the immigrant story is one of the major themes of Canadian Black history. The majority of Black people in Canada today come from the Caribbean, whether they were born there or their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents were born there. And there are many, many success stories among them. But one day, on the airplane home to Jamaica, I came face-to-face with another side of the story. I was seated beside a very polite young man and learned that he, like me, came from a country village in Jamaica. Are you interested in my reading about that? Okay, you're not bored yet? You're not falling asleep? Okay, so let me find page 147. So I asked him, what was life like in your village? His face lit up. Although his parents had gone abroad when he was very young, he said, he was raised by two loving people, his grandparents. They were poor, but his childhood was happy. His was a story I knew well. Jamaican parents trying to make a better life for themselves and their children, going abroad to where the jobs are. In fact, my father left my mother and the five children to go to England to earn the money to build a house for our family, because my grandmother was from a quite illustrious family, and they had a lot of land, and she had a big house. And he never thought he was good enough. And he had to go away to get the money to build the house to show her. I think it was part of the reason was to show her that he was good enough, you know. And he was gone for almost 10 years. They never saw each other for 10 years. And my mother held the fort and built the house while he earned the money, working day and night in England. So back to the story. In the 50s and early 60s, while Jamaica was still a colony of Britain, the jobs were mostly in England. In the four decades that followed, however, Jamaicans went in greater numbers to the U.S. and Canada. Many of these men and women left their spouses behind with the children, but some traveled as couples to jobs abroad, leaving their children in the care of their own parents until they had established themselves in the new country. As my seatmate spoke, I saw, in my mind's eye, his grandmother taking him to school, his grandfather helping him with his homework. I saw them showing him how to shine his shoes, tuck his shirt into his trousers, buckle his belt, comb his hair, and go to church. I saw them reminding him to pray for his mother and father every night, to pray that God would keep them safe in Canada, one of the ways they tried to keep the boy's parents present in his young mind. As a teenager, he continued softly, I was sent away from home to join my parents in Toronto. His friends envied him, he said, because everyone in his village wanted to come to Canada, the land of opportunity. He himself had been scared about the new country, about the parents he no longer remembered. But his grandparents had been so hopeful for his life in Canada that he became hopeful too. I thought about his words, sent away from home. It must have been wrenching to leave his village, to leave the people he knew, the kids he'd gone to school with and played with, and the adults who had parented him, his grandparents. Then, skipping entirely over his time in Canada, he added, "Now I'm going home for good." I had heard that phrase 100 times, but suddenly it struck me as strange. Would anyone ever go home for bad? Our breakfast arrived. About to start eating, I noticed a familiar ritual taking place beside me. Head bowed, lips moving in a whispered prayer, my seatmate was giving thanks for his meal. Not the quick, "For what we are about to receive, we give you thanks, O God," but a lengthy prayer. Giving thanks to God for my meal had been a staple of my small village upbringing in Jamaica. When had I stopped saying it? I couldn't recall. My mother's face flashed into my mind. I knew she did before every meal exactly what this young man was doing. I felt a twinge of shame. Deciding to follow his example, I silently mumbled a prayer of my own. Unlike my seatmate, however, I chose the brief version and self-consciously raced through it. Now, this is long before I became a warden, and this was when I was flying high and winning all the awards, and you know, at that stage in your life where you really think that you're responsible for all your success, you know? And I had, at this stage in my life, also lost touch with my church. I wasn't really going to church regularly. I was kind of high on my own supply, to tell you the truth. So back to this. For a while, we continued the flight in silence. And then the young man asked me how long I'd lived in Canada. "Most of my life," I said. "How about you?" He paused. "Not very long." "How long?" "Only about 6 years." "So, are you finished with your studies?" I asked. "Or do you work?" "I studied a bit." "And then you worked?" "Kinda." A bleak look came over his face. I took off my jacket and headed down the aisle to the washroom. "Excuse me, but is this yours?" The young man asked me when I was back in my seat. He had something between his fingers and held it out toward me. It was a ring. I looked down at my hand, then back at the ring. It was a precious piece of jewelry given to me years before by a beloved relative. "Thank you so much," I said. "That is very kind of you." Taking the ring, I slid it back on my finger, picturing how it had come loose. Before going to the washroom, I had tugged at my close-fitting jacket sleeve to remove the garment. The cloth had obviously become snagged on the protruding jewel and had pulled the ring off my finger. How lucky I was to be sitting beside an honest person. Now, sorry. I discovered when the flight ended that this very honest young man and very religious young man that I was sitting beside was a deportee. And that's why he didn't answer my questions about what he had done in Canada and why he was going home. And I only realized when the flight attendant came and told him to sit there and wait till everybody had left the plane, and he couldn't meet my eyes. And on the way home, my relatives told me that that meant he was a deportee. And suddenly it just all made sense. So I'm home now with my mom, and I'm going to be there for 7 days. And I'm remembering a conversation from my teenage years that I had with my mother. "How come some people succeed and some people fail?" I once asked her. "Ah, my dear," she replied, as though trying to figure it out herself. "Parenting, ambition, education, hard work, discipline, money, choices. Then Mama sighed and added one more thing to her long list. And grace. A lot of grace. Grace, I asked. You can have all those things, do all the right things, and still fail. Sometimes it's also about getting the opportunity and help you need at just the right time. Grace. There it was again, grace. Some people call it luck, fortune, or fate, but Mama always called it grace. I hadn't given it much thought before, yet what my mother termed grace had taken many forms throughout my life, from a mother who never stopped believing in me to a young stranger returning a precious ring. And repeatedly, those moments of unexpected help coming at just the right moment had helped me to take one path when I might easily have taken another. As the shadows lengthened and deepened on the mountainside and the air grew cool, the animals and birds quieted down for the night. After we got ready for bed, I knocked at Mama's bedroom door, requesting a small favor. Bringing back thoughts of the many times she and I had done this during my childhood, and thoughts of a young boy doing the same with his grandparents, we knelt beside her bed and prayed for a young man whose name we didn't know, returning to a village whose name I'd heard once but immediately forgot. We prayed that he might receive the opportunity to come home for good. History is always in the making. At this church, at Lansing United, at my church, around us, and in Canada's Black community. Success stories take time and sacrifice from many people, not just one. One of the things I learned and was reminded of was that God was always there guiding my path throughout life. Even when I thought I was a big hotshot traveling around the world, changing the world, God was always there guiding me. There are heroes among us, often not recognized until long after their work is done. Nearly 10 years ago, I had an accident that severely curtailed my capacity to work and to volunteer in the community and at church. My husband had his hands full, taking care of me and work, but he never stopped his commitment to our community or our church. He's here today, and he is one of my heroes. In fact, these are the kind of people that help the Black community to keep moving forward. There are many, many thousands of volunteers in our Black community, and many of them are in churches like this. You may know Hamlin Grange from his work as a CBC journalist and news anchor, but he has done very much to help our community. He's won many awards for his contributions to journalism and to the community. The BBPA honored him a few years ago, the YMCA gave him its Peace Medallion, and he recently got the Queen's Jubilee Medal, among many other distinctions. He co-founded the Heritage Rome Awards, the Black Business and Professional Association, the Scholarship Fund. He served on the Police Services Board, the ROM, the YMCA, Canadian Women in Communications, on and on. When Hamlin ended his second term on the Police Board, he chose to go to something called the Consent and Capacity Board, which, among other things, makes decisions about whether people who are mentally ill should be forced into treatment. He knew from his work on the police board that a number of people who end up in prison are mentally ill, but he also could see what was happening to immigrants, that there are a lot of immigrants end up with mental issues. It is not glamorous work. It is tough community work. And it's part of the history of Black people in this country. There are always people who are sacrificing and working so hard to help to better the generation today and the generation tomorrow. As I close, I want to remind you all that what we do today becomes history tomorrow. We're all part of this thing that is sometimes called the Canadian experiment, but I prefer to call it the Canadian experience. Through our interactions with each other and through the tough work and sacrifices we make today in the most multicultural nation on earth, we're making history ourselves. We are in that conversation that began long before we were born and will continue long after we are dead. We're also all part of Black history in this country. Harry Gary and Donald Moore and Bromley Armstrong always reminded me that there were other people who took the train with them to Ottawa to change the immigration laws. And throughout our history, there are other people blacks, whites, and in between, who did their part to help to improve the lot and the experience of blacks in this country. That we didn't do it alone. Others are part of the change. The United Church and the Anglican Church themselves have also done much to make life better for immigrants, and I think you know that better than I do. And so today I salute those who have gone before, those who are making their contributions today, and those who will inherit the results of our work tomorrow. Thank you, and thanks be to God. Amen.